Blog Talk Radio. Welcome, everyone, to the DM Burley Show. And we're live here on Blog Talk Radio. And tonight, I have a special guest, a friend of the show, someone that everyone should know about. How can I explain this? Our health is dwindling here in the United States. Why? There's a lot of diseases. There's a lot of things that we're taking, thinking that pharmaceutical medicines are going to help. There are things that we don't know what is causing, you know, our ailments, and we're taking supplements, we're taking everything, trying to figure it out. Well, we should look towards the science community. Science community investigates, looks into, and develops the real cures of things that ail us. And then it's handed over to doctors, and then it moves forward there. The person I have on the show is an extraordinary man. It's worked very hard in the science community, looking into things such as the causes for Lyme disease, ALS, various other reasons why these diseases exist and what it is that it takes to get them out of our system. And I'm going to bring him on now because I want him to talk about, you know, some of the things that he's been working on. And I'm going to introduce you to Professor Garth Nicholson. Garth, are you there? Can you talk? Can you hear me? Okay. Are you there? Let's see. Can you hear me? I don't know why. Can you hear me well? Okay. I don't know what's going on here. Hold on, I'm having issues here. Speaker, I don't know why I can't hear you on this other device. Okay. Can you hear me now? Sir? Hello? Garth, can you hear me?
We're having issues here. I'm not sure what's going on. Let me try one other thing. I'm going to see if I can call him back in. Garth, can you hear me? Okay, could you hear me before? Are you there? Can you hear me? Okay, I don't know what happened. Hold on, I'm going to transfer you back in. Hold on. Everyone, hold on. I'm trying to get this straightened. Hold on. I got everything written out now. Thank you for calling back in, and we're here live on Blog Talk Radio. And I wanted to discuss your career, Garth. Can you tell our listeners about you, how you got involved with, you know, science in the first place, in the beginning?
Well, I should say that I'm a professor emeritus of pathology and laboratory medicine. I was a department chairman for approximately 20 years at the University of Texas Medical School in Houston and the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. That's my background. I became interested in a number of subjects which were non-cancer because my stepdaughter served in the first Gulf War and came back with an illness that nobody wanted to really recognize, Gulf War illness. But it was real. And we work with her and a lot of her colleagues in the 101st Airborne, identify what this illness was caused by and come up with a treatment for it, and she fully recovered and went on. It ended her career in the Army. She was training to be a pilot, and she had to give that up. And but she went on eventually to medical school and is now a practicing neurologist in the Chicago area. So it worked out okay for her, but for a lot of thousands of other veterans, it didn't work out so well because they weren't able to get the assistance they needed and get the diagnosis that they needed to actually recover.
So what was that disease? What was it? You know, I think they claimed it as being Gulf War syndrome. Was it?
Well, that was, you know, what they coined it, but we call the Gulf War illnesses plural because there were really a number of different illnesses that were involved. We really worked with the illnesses that spread to immediate family members because those had to be biological, those had to be infections. And this constituted about 45% of the population that was sick, according to our data. And in the individuals that passed the illness to their family members, to their spouses, and eventually to their children, we identified an infection called a mycoplasma in all those patients, and the same species of mycoplasma in the veterans as we found in the immediate family members. So it was clear that this was what was being passed, not something else.
Well, is this a disease that they, you know, came upon by being in a foreign country, or how did it, you know, how did it arise in their system? Where did it come
from?
Well,
we think that they actually got this as a contaminant in the military vaccines. And there's some evidence for this, by the way, because we tested a few people that were immunized. They received about 30 of these vaccines before they were to be deployed, but they were never deployed because the war ended so quickly. And a few of these came down sick, and they had the same infection as the veterans who were deployed. And
well,
we also
this disease, had people, I want to ask you real briefly on this. This disease that they, you know, got maybe from a vaccination or whatever, when they came back here, you know, you said spread to family and children in their family. What was the likelihood of, you know, other civilians here in the United States contacting it? Was it something that was actually, you know, something that was dangerous to everyone, or was just something, a species of just went from family member to family member?
Well, it certainly put their families at risk, but we were also dealing with physicians and nurses on Gulf War referral centers at VA hospitals, who many, you know, some of whom became sick because of their contact with veterans, and in some cases, coworkers. For example, one of the things that we had to deal with were pilots who came back, and they continued flying. Most of them were reserve pilots, and so they had positions as commercial pilots. And they would spend, you know, long periods of time in a cockpit with another individual. And often what happened is that both of these people would come down with the infection. One would
have what was this infection like? Was it, you know, like a flu-like symptom type thing? Or
well, it starts as kind of a flu-like symptom, but then it progresses to have, you know, these patients, when they're severe, they have 30 to 50 different signs and symptoms. And it, with different individuals, it can go different routes. In some individuals, it became more of a rheumatoid arthritis problem. In other individuals, they had coronary problems. And so it really depended a lot on the individual, you know, which way it went. And there were different susceptibilities, of course, among different individuals. So not everybody had the same collection of signs and symptoms, but there was a general list of signs and symptoms that most people had, including things like fatigue and other problems, which I won't go into in detail, but it's in our publications and on our website, which if anybody's interested, they can go to our website for the Institute for Molecular Medicine. It's IMMED.org, like immediate.org. And there they can find that information. You just have to go to Gulf War Illness Research, for example. But because of the work and because of the overlap in signs and symptoms with a lot of civilians who were sick from before the Gulf War, for example, we decided to take a look at chronic infections in individuals with fatiguing illnesses. So these are people with chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia syndrome, and so on. And we found that the majority of those patients also had the same type of, not exactly the same infection, but the same class of infection.
Is that something that, you know, did the AMA recognize this as a, you know, issue? You know, was it, you know, known in the, you know, the public eye that this was going on, or was it just kind of hidden?
Well, it wasn't well known, let's put it that way. We published quite a bit on this, and which is available on our website, for example. There were different areas where people knew a lot more information. For example, at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, they knew a lot about this, actually. And they had published on it and even had a patent that they had applied for and obtained for the organism that we found in the veterans. So they knew a lot about it from before the Gulf War.
And you said it was fatigue syndrome added into there. You know, isn't that, you know, we were talking, you know, before you came on the show about fibromyalgia, and that's kind of a situation that adds in fatigue. So was fatigue something that, you know, is connected to fibromyalgia, which is connected back to the same strain you're talking about?
Yes. In fact, we deal a lot with fibromyalgia patients. In fact, I'm just initiating a new clinical trial for fibromyalgia patients. Fibromyalgia patients in many cases can be considered a fatiguing illness because fatigue is one of the common symptoms. But in addition, fibromyalgia patients, of course, have widespread pain, particularly peripheral pain, as a common denominator. And we think that the chronic infections have a lot to do with that because they inflame the nerves, and this causes pain. And these infections are considered to be neurotropic. They can spread into the central nervous system and peripheral nervous systems and cause, in the case of the peripheral nervous system, widespread pain. In the case of the central nervous system, they can cause a lot of problems, everything from headaches and memory losses and sometimes symptoms that look like multiple sclerosis. So that can cause a lot of different problems. And when we started to look at these neurodegenerative diseases, as they're called, in more detail, we found something really surprising when we started to look at things like Lou Gehrig's disease or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. We found that we started with the Gulf War veterans, of course, because we knew, you know, a lot more about them, and 100% of them had this infection. But when we looked at civilians, we found similar infections in about 80% to 85% of civilians. So we think that this is a major cofactor in the disease. It may not be the only thing involved in the disease, and we don't think it is the only thing involved, but it's a major factor, and it may be important for causing cell death, because one of the things that these mycoplasma microorganisms do is they damage cells, and they can actually kill cells and send them into a death spiral, and that's an important part of the infectious process. So we know with diseases like Lou Gehrig's disease or ALS that there's a lot of neural cell death involved in that, and so that could be part of the explanation for it.
Well, what's the Lou Gehrig's disease? You know, I thought that was kind of radically you know, removed from, you know, the basis of illnesses. You don't hear of people getting it, you know, like before. Is it still out there, you know, ALS?
Well, it's actually increasing in incidence. And if this were just a genetic disease, you wouldn't expect it to increase so sharply in incidence like it has been in the last few years. And in fact, most of the neurodegenerative diseases have increased quite dramatically in incidence, and you can't predict that on the basis of a genetic explanation. So
the Gehrig disease right now, you said it's increasing. And it's not really being, and, you know, I haven't heard anyone mention that disease in years. So, you know, when people go to get diagnosed, are they being diagnosed properly, would you say now? Because a lot of these diseases kind of mimic other diseases.
Well, they have a certain set criteria for the diagnosis of the various neurodegenerative diseases. I'm not going to go into detail on it because it would take too long, frankly, but usually this is done by neurologists, and in general they know what they're doing. They're very good at diagnosing disease, not so good at treating it, but good at diagnosing it. And in general, well, people that go to a neurologist and get a diagnosis of Lou Gehrig's disease or ALS, generally they're told there's no treatment available, and they just monitor them. And, of course, ultimately they die, and that's no way to really approach this type of disease process.
So you looked into this, Lou Gehrig's disease, and the similarity to the strains that were coming back with the Gulf War on the individuals. And the thing is that it seems to be sort of a parallel. And how about the situation even with Alzheimer's? You know, you have individuals out there that are losing memory, you know.
Let's back up just a second. The way we got involved in looking at neurodegenerative diseases is because we were looking at Gulf War veterans. And these were young people. These were average age, less than 25. They were in perfect health, or at least certainly in very good health, when they were deployed. So we had a baseline there. These were people that were well. They were deployed. They were young. And when they came back, they had a disease process that ultimately resulted in a diagnosis of ALS. Well, that's extremely rare with a young population. Usually ALS is the onset is middle age, not young people in their early 20s. So this was unusual to begin with. But, you know, the diagnosis fit. And so these people did have ALS. And so we were looking at that population. And then we started looking as a control civilians with ALS and found that they also had not exactly the same infection, but a similar infection. And in fact, in the civilian population, they had a number of different infections that we found that were some were similar, some were different. So we concluded that, okay, the civilians look somewhat similar to the veterans. They have the same, may have the same disease process. And those infections, we think, play an important role in the progression of the disease, along with genetic and other different problems as well. That's not the only problem associated with these diseases, but we think that these infections may be the trigger, or certainly in the young cases, they appeared to be the trigger, because these people were all healthy and not expected to come down with ALS, and yet did.
So now, after, you know, you've done these studies on this, what is the success ratio on, you know, the people that you are seeing that are looking at, you know, trials and seeing if there's anything that can be done to, you know, eradicate what they have, like, you know, Lou Gehrig's disease or ALS or, you know, even Lyme's disease? Is there a success ratio that you're seeing with people?
Well,
you know,
we started dealing with, you know, quite a large group of veterans and their treatment problems, and our treatment suggestions have evolved over the years, and those documents are actually on our website. And we've used not only combinations of antibiotics, but natural supplements as well to support the healing process. And we've had pretty good success in helping veterans recover. Less success with ALS in that if we got the early onset cases, we were pretty successful. But if they were allowed to progress to a certain degree, it was very, very difficult to reverse it. We, in some cases, were able to stop the progression, but in most cases, by the time people are diagnosed, it's late in the disease process, and that makes it very difficult.
And how about something like MS? You know, is it something that could be reversed? Because I guess, you know, I was talking to you earlier, you said that these cells can manifest itself inside a, you know, healthy cell, grow in that healthy cell, and lodge itself in your body and multiply, I gather. And, you know, people are getting ill all over the place, you know, and not knowing, you know, what to do. Do you think, I just want to ask you a curiosity, you know, everybody's into supplement mode here in the United States. So they're going into, you know, health food stores, they're getting, you know, extra vitamins and supplements and, you know, nutritional things. Can that help to ease or stop this progression of these, you know, ailments based on this you know, these diseases, or it doesn't do
well,
it
can help, but that's not enough to stop the disease process. But it can certainly help, and there are various supplements, and we use some ourselves. We, one that I mentioned, this clinical trial that we're running on fibromyalgia, one of the very successful supplements that we've had actually repairs the cell membranes, and it repairs nerve membranes as well as other cell membranes, and repairs the membranes of the mitochondria inside the cell. Now, the mitochondria are the little batteries that provide 80 to 90% of our cellular energy. And so they're extremely important for cells. And, of course, nerve cells have a very high activity, so they need a lot of energy. So if the mitochondria are damaged in nerve cells, that's pretty significant for them. They cannot maintain the cell membrane polarity, electrical polarity that's necessary. And so we think this is one of the problems that they have. And it can also, because the mitochondria damages can lead to a phenomenon called programmed cell death. And so those cells can actually die. And so we think that this is involved in some of the neurodegenerative disease processes. So certainly supplements that help mitochondria, like this one that we're using, which is made up of mitochondrial membrane lipids in particular, called NT factor, this does help repair the mitochondria, and so people get some benefit from this. It's not a panacea, but they certainly get a tremendous benefit. There's very significant reductions in fatigue. There are also reductions in pain, and we're going to be testing that in our fibromyalgia trial very, very carefully, along with gastrointestinal symptoms and other symptoms that fibromyalgia patients have. So we're going to look in detail at pain really for the first time, although we've looked at it superficially in other trials. We'll really focus in on this using some standard really ways of looking at the sensation of pain. And these are using validated instruments that look for pain in patients.
Oh.
So,
let me ask you this question too, Professor. If you have fibromyalgia and, the pain is, again, you're talking inflammation. You know, everybody tells you when you have inflammation, take ibuprofen or take, Tylenol or take a supplement, something that would be able, DHEA or something like that that would, milled in to try to release something, to get rid of this thing in the system. Does that really work, or is that taking another step higher?
Well, again, it helps some patients, but it's not a panacea. We do know that things like the mitochondrial membrane and the nerve plasma membranes get damaged during this disease process, and this can cause widespread pain, peripheral pain, for example. And so those have to be repaired. And so the supplement that we're using called NT Factor does repair those membranes, and it's a natural membrane lipid supplement. The difference between this and other supplements is these are carefully chosen membrane glycerol phospholipids that make up the matrix of the membrane of the mitochondria and the plasma membrane. These are not just ordinary lipids.
Mm-hmm.
And so these special types of lipids are protected so that you can take them orally. Protected meaning that they have some additives into the lipids. In fact, we use a plant additive called the fructooligosaccharide to protect the lipids so they're not damaged in the gut, because normally they're broken down. And these are then taken in whole without being broken down and are transferred eventually to cells, and they circulate and they get into all your tissues and all your cells. And so
well,
we know
it's transferred to the person with this. Is it transferred through IV or, is it a pill form? What is it?
Well, when it gets in, orally, it comes through the brush border lining of your intestines, and then gets in primarily as small lipid globules protected with these fructooligosaccharides, and these are picked up by cells and by circulating lipoproteins, and they travel all over the body through the blood circulation. They're given off to endothelial cells and various tissues and organs, and so eventually this gets into every cellular compartment in your body, and that's important actually. And the repair process is really based upon the natural functions and repair mechanisms that we have already in our cells, because these are very important molecules, and we have evolved with ways to shuttle these molecules in and put them into membranes because they're so important. They do get damaged because they're susceptible to oxidative damage, and so we have to keep repairing them all the time. We can't it's not a one-shot deal. You just have to take these long-term.
So with this,
situation that you're seeing occurring out here, you know, is it just prevalent to the United States, or are you seeing this as a global issue?
Well, we know that when these lipids come in, they get dispersed throughout the body, and they do get into the mitochondria, and we can actually see this because that the mitochondria are being repaired because the mitochondria have two membranes around them, an outer membrane and an inner membrane, and on the inner membrane is the oxidative phosphorylation complexes that really drive the energy process, and that inner membrane has a chemical electrical potential across the inner membrane of about minus 150 millivolts, and if that's not maintained, you can't make high energy molecules.
Mm-hmm.
And so this helps maintain that potential. We can actually measure the potential of the inner mitochondrial membrane, and we know that if people take these supplements, when that degrades and they can't make enough high energy molecules, we put this in and they slowly build that back up again, and that potential goes back to where it should be, and they start making ATP, make energy, and then their fatigue levels go down accordingly. So we've done trials where we give them supplement and they recover their mitochondrial potential while their fatigue goes down, but if we then switch them to placebo without their knowledge, then it all goes back again. So we know that this is working, and we know that people's mitochondria are responding to these supplements.
Well, let me ask you this, Garth. Now, we have a huge level of population here in the United States that all of a sudden is seemingly has diabetes. Is that, you know, one of these type of, you know, man-made diseases? You know, what exactly is going on with this, you know, diabetic type of scenario? And does this add in to what you're trying to do?
You know, we're seeing a lot of type 2 diabetes in our country, and part of the reasons for that is obesity and the bad diets that we have, and this really leads to a lot of problems. And one of the problems is this increase in these free radical oxidants that damage our cells and can damage our insulin signaling processes inside cells, and eventually the people become insulin resistant, then they become eventually a type 2 diabetic. Before that happens, they go through a process called metabolic syndrome, and this is characterized by differences in their lipid profiles, differences in their insulin sensitivities, for example, and insulin resistance, and a number of other characteristics, sometimes hypertension, and so on. So it's a long, slow process to become a type 2 diabetic, and this intermittent part, metabolic syndrome, is where we really need to focus our efforts, because this is where we can eventually stop the progression to type 2 diabetes. So there are a number of things that are involved in this, but one of the more important things is obesity and these lipid profiles, these lipid changes, and the oxidative stress that seems to be involved as well. So we need to work on all these different aspects. There are others as well, but those are some of the important points that we can approach to try and stop the formation of metabolic syndrome and eventually stop it from progressing to type 2 diabetes.
Oh, well, the thing I'm amazed at, you know, I talked to you, and there's another gentleman that's a scientist in another state about 3-4 away from where you are currently. And my concern is that, you know, people are running around out here, and you don't know what they have, and, you know, it might be the most, you know, wonderful person, but, you know, I'm just saying that there's people out here, they just don't know what to do, Professor. They're sick, they go into hospitals, they get all these different levels of pain medication just to mimic away from the pain, and so what would you suggest that these people do? You know, should they speak out and get involved with various trials that they're seeing? Or is there, you
well,
know, certain people that they need to, you know, talk to about this stuff?
Well, that's certainly helpful if they, you know, live in an area where clinical trials are available to afford themselves of that, because this is how progress is made, and it doesn't happen overnight. It's a slow, incremental progress, and I think we are making slow progress against some of these disease processes, but against that backdrop, people have to lead more healthy lives, frankly. And it really starts with diet in exercise and some of the very basic things that people need to do to correct some of the problems early on so that it doesn't progress to things like metabolic syndrome or some of these pre-disease states that eventually progress to more difficult disease states in terms of treatment. So,
well, how about the situation with these kids coming down with autism. You know, there seems to be more and more autism, and people are focusing that, saying that that is the cause is coming from them, you know, basically getting vaccinated. And
well, we've actually done some work on autism spectrum disorders. In fact, I have a couple of major publications in this area, and one of the things that we found both here in California and in Texas were that the majority of these young patients had chronic infections, and this was, we felt, an important cofactor in their disease process. And it also set up a number of other situations where their cells could be damaged, their development could be damaged, for example, because of damage to their central nervous system. And this, we feel quite strongly, creates a scenario for things like autism and other related disease processes, these behavioral disease processes. So interesting, I got into that as well through the Gulf War veterans, because when the Gulf War veterans came home and spread their infections to family members, one of the things we noticed early on was that the young children were becoming autistic in these families. And so that was a tip-off right away that the infection was part of the process. And this is not well recognized, although we published in clinical journals that this happens. I think it's still not well recognized among pediatricians that infection is an important part of the process of autism spectrum disorders. And so we could take these young, very young children and provide them with not only support mechanisms and mechanisms to repair their cells, for example, like I was mentioning with the NT factor lipids, but also treat them for their infections, because not all of them have the same infections. They have a different series of different infections. But these people did extremely well with those kinds of treatments. But it's not something that is ordinarily or routinely recognized among pediatricians.
And what is a lipid, by the way? You know, I heard you mention that. What is that? Is that something you can, you know, get in a health food store? What is a lipid?
Well, you can get it online. You can get it in some health food stores. It's called NT factor, NT factor. And these lipids are membrane lipids, particularly they're balanced for the inner mitochondrial membrane, which is incredibly important in disease processes because it provides energies for cells, all of our cells of our body. And if our energy levels go down, we're much more susceptible to a variety of disease processes. So this is extremely important. And so
this lipid that you're talking about, combined with certain antibiotics, can help repair some of this stuff?
Well, that's what we're trying to do, actually. That's exactly what we're trying to do. Separately, we have to test these different things. And, for example, this fibromyalgia trial that we're starting in three clinics in Texas will be testing the NT factor lipids for their ability to shut down pain and other processes, for example, like gastrointestinal symptoms and fatigue and so on and pain. And these are things that are very common in fibromyalgia patients. So we'll be looking at those very directly and some other symptoms as well, but those principal symptoms.
Now, can the people listening to the show, are any of these, you know, these products like lipids available on your website, or that's something
The website is, for the Institute for Molecular Medicine, is www.imed.org. It's like immediate.org. And there they can look under various disease categories, for example, and find information. There's, you know, lots of publications. There's over 100 publications that they can download from our website directly. If people want to see the details, they're there. If they want just a synopsis, that's there as well. And so,
what do you feel is going on with this? Is, you know, is this weaponized diseases we're looking at that, you know, are hitting us? Or, you know, where is this, you know, going to? You know, I mean, we had another thing. I don't know if this is interrelated or not, but, you know, when that Ebola thing was spun out, you know, about, it was about close to a year ago, you know, everybody was fearful that people were going to come back from, you know, Liberia here to the United States and spread, you know, Ebola. Now, is Ebola one of these diseases tied into the same, you know, these same factors we're talking about here?
No. No, Ebola is a hemorrhagic fever virus. Most of the infections that we've dealt with are small little bacteria that get inside cells, so they're intracellular bacteria. We see these in, for example, Lyme disease. We see them in a variety of different chronic illnesses. So Ebola is acute illness, acute viral viremia is involved with this hemorrhagic fever virus called Ebola. So that's a different disease process that depends upon a very acute infection. So what we're talking about are chronic infections. So these are smoldering, slow infections that are hard to find. They're deep inside cells. They don't immediately cause cell death or destruction. It's a very slow process of degeneration. And so that's really what we're talking about. So these very slow infections or chronic infections are the ones that seem to be involved in a lot of the chronic diseases that we see so prominently in our population.
And the situation now is, you know, when you do these clinical studies and you rely on support from where? Other institutes or the general public? How do you, you know, get the funding you need?
Well, they come from a variety of sources. There is a allergy research group which is providing funding for this clinical trial in Texas, for example, and other trials that we've run, we've had funds provided by the different sources, some government, mostly non-government sources, because we're, you know, dealing with chronic illnesses, and it's not so popular to for government funding agencies to support studies with chronic illnesses compared to acute illnesses. So we have to get money from a variety of. Well, I think it's just the severity of the illnesses. If you take something like Ebola virus, that is so severe, for example, and it's so shocking to people that you know, funding is available for something like that. But for chronic illnesses that are, you know, they're smoldering illnesses that are present in the population, but mostly people don't see that as an immediate threat, then there's not so much funding available for something like that. So for these chronic illnesses that cause, for example, fatigue, like the fatiguing illnesses or the illnesses like fibromyalgia and this, that, there's really not a lot of funding available to work on these sorts of things. So we have to find it wherever we can.
That's really interesting. Now, I just wanted to find out, you see any other thing that is a future disease, super virus? I'm hearing there's super viruses coming out now that are totally can't be wiped out from using antibiotics. Is that true? Or
well, viruses aren't susceptible to antibiotics. You have to use antivirals to treat virals because it's different, completely different type of infection compared to a bacteria. So you use completely different drugs to treat those two different forms. And one of the things that we've found, because we often find some viral co-infections with some of the disease processes, that immune enhancement, our immune systems are actually pretty good at attacking viruses. If the immune system isn't damaged, they're generally pretty good at that. If we can boost them, they actually do quite well. On the other hand, they're not so good at these intracellular bacteria because these are bacteria that get inside our cells, and so they're kind of sequestered away from the immune system, so the immune system can't really directly attack them. So those are the ones that we've worked on primarily, and those are the kinds of bacteria that cause Lyme disease, and they're involved in chronic diseases of all sorts. These are the kind of things that cause, for example, rheumatoid arthritis, and when they get in the joints and the synovium, get inside the cells there and cause havoc and cause kind of autoimmune reactions as well. And so this can cause a lot of pain and swelling and problems. And in terms of fatiguing illnesses, these bacteria release substances like free radical oxidants that attack the mitochondrial membranes, and the mitochondria are the little batteries inside our cells. When those are attacked and they're not running efficiently, they don't provide the high energy molecules, and so we that energy goes down, and that is, you know, translated into fatigue at the level of you know, our bodies. We feel that as fatigue when we don't have enough energy to function. So energy is necessary for all kinds of different things that go on in our bodies, so maintaining the proper energy balance is incredibly important. So we think that people should be taking these lipid supplements, because in our unhealthy diets that we eat today, we eat a lot of things that can damage our mitochondria, and so we need to keep repairing them at all times. So, and I take this stuff every day myself, and so it's really, I think it's really important.
Well, you know, now these clinical trials that you're doing right now, you said that you have them in two states. One is in Texas. I forgot the other. The other one is in, what, California?
Well, the one that we're running right now, that I'm actually just we're just in the process of getting it approved by an independent review board and getting it. It's funded. We're getting it approved. We're going to start it in the next month or two, and it'll be at three clinics in Texas. And the reason we're running it there is that we have the patient base that's present in South Central Texas to run it there, and we have the physicians there who want to do it. And so that's sometimes a problem. Getting clinics organized to do a clinical trial is not easy. Often you have to do these at major medical centers, and they're very expensive. If you run a trial at a major medical center, it literally costs millions of dollars.
Wow.
For these natural supplements that we're testing, these are made by small companies that don't have millions of dollars to run clinical trials. So we have to go to small clinics to run these kinds of trials, and that's primarily what we've done here in California and other places.
And the type of antibiotic that's being used, is it in the family class of the standard, you know, antibiotic, what is that, that they had up for years, and it escaped my memory, penicillin. Is it in the
For the intracellular bacteria, we don't use penicillins, because those are not effective against these type of bacteria that don't have a cell wall. The penicillin that prevents bacteria, extracellular bacteria, from making a cell wall, and that's their demise. But when the bacteria are inside cells, often these are bacteria without a cell wall. And these type of bacteria, although they're bacteria, they're not susceptible to penicillin at all.
You have
to use other anti-metabolic antibiotics. We use tetracyclines. We use different types of antibiotics.
That's interesting. You mentioned tetracycline. I've been to the doctor a lot, you know, over the course of years. I've had several very bad car accidents, and I had some other health issues that happened. And I had a couple infections, and I realized that, you know, tetracycline was a pretty good drug. So when you go into, you know, standard medical doctors, they will not prescribe tetracycline, you know, anything else, you know, amoxicillin, anything other than going towards, you know, tetracycline. Why is that?
Well, again, it's biased, but, you know, often for these, if they see an acute, if they think it's an acute infection, then these are generally extracellular, fast-growing bacteria, and then things like amoxicillin or penicillin are pretty potent. But these slow-growing, smoldering intracellular infections, bacteria without cell walls, they're not susceptible to those types of antibiotics at all. Then you have to use other types of antibiotics. And floxacins, for example, various tetracyclines. We like doxycycline a lot for a lot of the conditions because it's a very good penetrating tetracycline. Tetracycline itself doesn't penetrate that well into cells and tissues, but doxycycline, which is a variant of tetracycline, does penetrate well. Minocycline, things like that, penetrate even better. So these are things that are used because they'll penetrate the blood-brain barrier, for example, and penetrate into nerve cells and get into the mitochondria even. So these are things that we go to out of necessity because the intracellular bacteria are sensitive to these kinds of things. But because these bacteria are slow-growing, smoldering infections, they're not really, highly sensitive to any bacterial treatment with antibiotics anyway. So you have to use long-term treatment, and that's something that most physicians just don't want to do. They don't want to treat. They under-treat. And if they under-treat, that's, in the long run, is often even worse because resistant forms of these bacteria then slowly arise, and then they're refractory to subsequent treatment with antibiotics, and it just makes it very, very difficult. They don't really understand why you have to use long-term treatment because these are microorganisms that have a cyclic nature to them, and so they're intermittent periods of sensitivity and then insensitivity, and so you have to keep treating them long-term to really get a good result. So it takes a long time to treat people with these intracellular, smoldering, slow-growing bacterial infections. And that's true with a number of different things. Lyme disease is another thing that can, because there are a number of different intracellular infections. Mycoplasma is one of them in Lyme, but also Bartonella, Babesia. These are other infections, along with the Borrelia, which is the main Lyme infection that characterizes Lyme. But it's not the only infection in Lyme. That's one reason why things like Lyme disease are so difficult to treat, because they have multiple infections that are involved, not just one infection. They're multiple intracellular infections. And so it's really difficult to treat something like Lyme disease. So you really have to go to a specialist. So we ran a trial on Lyme disease to see if, for example, we could help them with these lipid supplements. And we showed that there was significant benefit if, along with their Lyme treatment against the Lyme bacterial infections and Babesia, another non-bacterial but closely related infection, if they were being treated, we also needed to repair the mitochondria, and we used NT factor to do that. And these patients actually did much better. They had much lower fatigue, much lower pain, much lower problems compared to other patients. So it's beneficial for therapy in general.
This is extraordinary because, I've been to a lot of places that have physicians, and I feel really being, there. But I want to just let me ask you this. Now, you are located in Texas as well where there's a clinical trial, or are you located somewhere else?
Well, we're located in California. The Institute for Molecular Medicine is a nonprofit research organization located in Southern California. But we have affiliates all over the world, really, that collaborate with us. And so we have ongoing collaborations. We have a major collaboration with the University of California at Irvine here in Southern California. We have collaborations with UCLA. We have collaborations at various places. The ones that are being run in Texas because of a particular area of Texas where there's a large number of fibromyalgia patients. And so we have clinics down there that we're affiliated with. And we have physicians down there that we can work with on this clinical trial. So that's why it's being done there. But we have run clinical trials here in Southern California at various clinics. We've run it at chronic disease clinics, at anti-aging clinics, and so on and so forth. So we like working with these small clinics in a way because, quite frankly, for these natural supplements, we don't have a lot of money and we can run a good clinical trial there. But if we want to do it with the university, it's very expensive. So we have to raise a lot of money to do a university-based trial.
And your work is very, very important. Please share with the audience here your website again. And is there anything they can do, to help you do your work in the general public?
Well, they can get involved. Usually people get involved because they need help. That's generally why people contact us, is they're not getting help from their physician or their clinic or the people they're going to, so they contact us to see if we can help them. Sometimes we can, sometimes we can't. If they have one of these chronic diseases, we give them a lot of advice on what to, diets, for example, that they need to use, supplements and so on and so forth that will help them. And a lot of situations involve really supplementary treatments. So we don't really change their major treatment. What we do is we add on top of that some dietary advice, some supplement, natural supplements that don't interfere with their treatment, but help their immune systems, help their, for example, mitochondrial function, and help a number of things so that they actually go through their therapy in better shape and recover faster and feel better and have a better quality of life. So that's one of the things that, that we're able to do.
Yeah, that's very important. Now, what is going on with the military men returning now? We talked about the past, you know, the ones from the Gulf War, you know, time, but now we have men that are returning from, you know, places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria. Are they running into the same type of exposure today, or it's not?
Well, not to the same degree, I think, because, you know, they've changed some of the military vaccines, so that's helped. They've also used a different schedule for the vaccines, which is very important, because for the first Gulf War, they were giving all the vaccines at once over a three-day period. That's crazy. That results in immunosuppression, and then we think that this is how some of these contaminants really took hold and became major problems. So there we were having a very high percentage of troops that were infected. And, by the way, a lot of those have now died.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. They're very large numbers are associated that from the first Gulf War that have died because of their diseases that progressed and became other things and so on. So without getting into that, it was a huge major problem, still is, but a lot of it's being covered up because they don't want to talk about it because it's more of a friendly fire problem created by our medical corps, frankly. So they don't want to really discuss that. But so some of those problems have been corrected. So we have fewer personnel coming back from war that are become chronically ill and fewer yet that spread their illnesses to family members. So that was a particular problem in the first Gulf War because of what they did. That it wasn't really repeated to the same extent in other wars, although there have been some problems because they're still using some of the same vaccines like the anthrax vaccine, which is a very dangerous vaccine and shouldn't be used. So some of the things are still going on, but other things have been corrected.
Well, the anthrax vaccine, did that not have that antibiotic, what was it, Cipro or something similar to that as a cure?
Well, you know, Cipro is one of the antibiotics that can be used against things like mycoplasma. They're better forms of Cipro, that it's a floxacin, but they're better floxacins that will penetrate better into cells and treat the intracellular forms of these bacteria. So it's interesting that in the first Gulf War, for example, the French forces that were involved in the war didn't have any problem with Gulf War illness. There were very few incidents of Gulf War illness among the French forces compared to the British, U.S., Canadian, Australian, and all those forces received the vaccines. It's almost the same vaccines. But the French forces didn't go that route. They used prophylactic antibiotics, and they didn't have the same problem with Gulf War illness that the other forces had. So there's a difference right there that tends to demonstrate that it's really a self-inflicted wound more than anything.
Okay. So let me just say this to you. I really appreciate you coming on my show today, because I'm doing a lot of programming here, Professor Garth, in regards to, you know, what people can do to get their lives, you know, better today. You know, in the United States, again, there's a huge population of people that are taking pain medication nonstop. You have other individuals that are finding themselves closer and closer to having either you know, conditions like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease, and they don't know where it's coming from, and they're looking for, you know, what they can do to cure it, but all they're getting is Band-Aid treatment, you know, where they're told to take, you know, countless numbers of pain medication to, basically cover the, you know, illness, so you won't feel it as much, but it's still there, it's not gone. So the thing that you're talking about, this that you're talking about, does that get rid of the inflammation, really, or is it more?
Well, they can certainly lower the inflammation. That's one of the things that they do. And, by the way, these are all natural, FDA-approved supplements that really have no toxicity whatsoever. In fact, we've yet to find a toxic dose of this. So these are incredibly safe, and that's the important thing that people really rave about, is that they've never had a problem with these. You know, there's always adverse events with all these painkillers and so on, but not so with this natural supplement that works naturally to try and reduce pain, inflammation, fatigue, and so on. So that's one of the reasons why we're really high on this.
Mm-hmm. So now, do you see another clinical study of it different than this coming up in the future, or you're just working on this one solely right now?
Well, I have to do these one at a time because they're, you know, they're complicated. This is a multi-center trial, so it's being run in three clinics. So there's a lot involved in doing this, and so I'm really, my time is limited. And so I have to focus on this, but there'll be other trials that we'll do, but this is my focus at the moment.
And when you run these clinical trials, are you running a lot of, there's a lot of people getting involved with that, or are you finding people being kind of scared to sign up for, you know, the trial?
Well, recruitment is always a problem with clinical trials. It's always hard to get people involved. The trial that we're running is what's called a crossover trial, which is a very ethical trial. Everybody gets the same treatment. It's just that they get a placebo and they get a, in this case, a supplement, but they get it at different times and they don't know what time they're getting each. So we can use that as a control. So that type of trial has to run a long time. It takes, you know, a number of participants. And so we need committed people to run these trials. That's always a problem.
Is it in-house done, or do they stay in a facility, or they just come and go?
Oh, they come and go. I mean, these are all people that just come to a clinic for and then they go home. And they actually, in our trial, they can report their symptoms online, so they don't have to come back to be examined. They can report everything by going onto a program, and they go through this program, and it really asks them questions, a number of different questions that they go through, and they answer those and their severity and this and that of signs and symptoms. And so they do it all in the comfort of their home, and then we can do it almost on a daily basis. But it requires a commitment of people to really want to do this. And we find that when doing these clinical trials, that a lot of people don't complete the trial because they just, for one reason or another, they lose interest, or in some cases people get the benefit and they say, hey, I'm feeling better, I don't need to do this anymore.
Oh, boy. But, you know, all this time that you've been in this field, there's been a lot of your colleagues that have been working on various other levels of this. I know your study is, you know, contained to this one particular area mostly. You know, I've been hearing a lot. Now, is it true that a lot of people in the science community, especially people that are in your field, that are ending up, you know, I hate to say it, something happens to them, and they've been murdered over the course of, you know, we've had lists of individuals of, you know, that have been working on various fields. Is this true, or is this a, you know, another fake news story that, you know?
No, it's not a fake news story. I mean, I can tell you that when I was first starting this work on Gulf War illnesses, that we'd actually stumbled across some illegal experimentation in the prison system in Texas. And it was, our lives were threatened. Some of my colleagues were actually died in unusual circumstances and so on. And actually my boss at the time, somebody walked in his office and shot him in the back of the head.
Oh, no, what?
So these are things that actually happened, and it's in my book, Project Daylily, where we discuss it in great detail. So if somebody's interested in the kind of the whodunit part of this and some of the bad stuff that happens to people when they get involved in working on these things, that they can get a hold of the book, Project Daylily.
I don't know. Did you know Professor Iam? He was with the University of Missouri. And he was working on cross genetics with the blood between man and animal. And he came there, and somehow he ended up shot and placed in the back of a car, and the car was set on fire. Did you know anything about his work, or did you know anything about him?
No, I didn't. You know, I had my own problems.
Okay, sorry.
But you know, I'm just saying, it's scary, you know, that scientists are really working very diligently to try to come up with, you know, some type of way of curing these things. You know, you're even working on something for anti-aging, and you know, it's kind of tied into this. Is it not? You know, this.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's tied into this because the mitochondria, which is what we're repairing with these natural lipid supplements, are all tied up in the aging process. And so if we repair them and get them to function better, it's virtually an anti-aging effect. And so that's one of the things that we're working on.
Well, I thank you very much for coming on my show. And I love having you on here. I've had you on in the past. And your work is really well, you know, needed. And you've done some excellent things for people out here, and I just like to applaud you. And I'd like to have you back again at another time, another date.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me on your show, and good luck.
Well, good luck to you, and thank you again. And this is Dr. Garth Nicholson, and he is an extraordinary man that's been out there working very hard to try to come up with cures for some of these diseases that we're, you know, facing here, you know, in the United States, and we just don't know what to do. It's just scary and sad. But I, again, thank him for coming on, you know, my show at short notice. But we're going to have some more programs like this because we're looking at, instead of just talking problem, here's the solution. You know, look for his clinical trial online. It's immed.org, and it's very important that we get more involved in these things and understand where these illnesses and diseases might be coming from, because that is a way that you can change your life. You know, again, I was looking at some of these studies, and it crosses into things like Parkinson's disease, ALS, MS, you know, fibromyalgia, and Lyme disease, and as we go, you know, it could be more, you know, added on as the science community is investigating. And this work is really, really, really needed, and we need to support it as much as we can. And if we can get involved with these clinical studies, because every time when we do, it gives another aspect of, you know, maybe possibly saving someone else's life and changing their life around radically. So this is Deanne here on Blog Talk Radio on the Detectors Radio Broadcast Network. And I thank you very much for listening. If you want a copy of this tape, call me at 718-508-9513. And we'll, you know, send it out to you. Again, we need to pass the word out wide and strong that this program is going to be for you, problem, solution. Now, tomorrow, we're going to have a wonderful young lady I met that has a chiropractic business in Chicago. It's called Genesis. It's in the West Loop area. And she's going to be talking about, you know, some of the things that you can do to maybe help you with some of the illnesses that you have. You can call in on that show. But she's going to talk about processes of using cupping. It's a Chinese method of placing cups on your body to draw out, you know, disease or, you know, move the blood around in surfaces. I had that done today. It was really extraordinary. She does also acupuncture, and she is a Reiki specialist, and she does chiropractic work and more. You know, she is also involved with, you know, trying to develop a cure and help for individuals out there. More programs are coming on like this. We're also dealing with the legal issue. Legal issue is this. Across the United States right now, we have a huge issue of people not realizing that our courts and policing, justice system is not working well for us. If you are in a situation of a person of color, it's not for you. Trust me, it's not. We're seeing more and more African-Americans getting caught up and locked up. And like the professor Garth had mentioned in Texas, they were doing these experiments, you know, in the prison system. Most likely, a lot of those people that we're talking about happened to be African-American and had gotten these, you know, injections or whatever they were doing for testing in prison systems. And a lot of these people that are being locked up, they're African-American and Latino. They are locked up in jail on crimes they may not have even committed. They just feel that they can do whatever they want. The judges, the people in the justice system, they are not doing what they are supposed to do. What I'm doing right now is I have some people I know, they're judges, and they're people in the legal profession that are JDs and others that are coming forth, and we're going to start doing a lot more to bring forth, you know, the question to Congress and Senate, and also the White House, the new White House. What are you going to do to clean up these courts? Now, back in the day, in the 1970s, you had the late Sherman Scully, but then you had people, brave judges, good judges, like Judge Brockton Lockwood. He was wearing a wire, and during the time of the Gray Lord hearings, he went in and, you know, as a judge, he sat there and allowed his colleagues to be overheard in regards to them receiving gifts and presents and things in regards to political favors for, you know, changing or creating convictions on individuals. And during the Gray Lord days, a lot of people went to jail that were not guilty of anything. There were a lot of people that ended up electrocuted in Illinois because of these judges. And they got, to me, a slap on the wrist. Some of them got just months in jail and released back out. They still got their pension. There was a situation where you have today the same scenario, Gray Lord, but there's no one doing anything about it. So the problem is, you know, hey, if I'm talking to individuals out there and they're contacting me about being lawfully jailed on the setup for 15 years, or you have another person or two or three or four or 500 of them that are in probate court, and the probate court is geared to take away the right of the elder person's decency, their homes, their life. Everything they worked hard for is gone overnight in the probate court, because what happens, probate assigns them their own people, and the person doesn't have any say-so over their life, because at this point now they're become a part of this court system that is basically attached themselves to everything this person owns, from their car to their clothing to their jewelry to their home, to the car, again, to their boat, anything that they own, any property, personal, non-personal, becomes a part of the debt they already have accumulated through the court system, putting them in this nightmare. Now, if you're a spouse, if you're a husband, again, if you're a child of these people, you're going to have to fight through a loophole that has no rights for you. Meaning that you're going to have your own lawyer, and your lawyer has little to say, because at this point the whole case is centered around your loved one, whether it's a husband, a wife, or a child, or whoever. You know, once they hit that golden age, they can be in a situation that they're going to be trapped in probate. And we're going to do a whole show on trapped in probate, because you need to hear what's going on. Because who knows who's next? As you approach getting older, they look at different things. How to make money off of you. It's not about keeping your belongings or keeping your house. You become a dollar sign. Because what happens is now you're sick, you've got chronic illnesses, and that means you're going to move more and more and more and more in the controlled medicine nightmare. And how that's going to happen, what is going to happen to you, is that you're going to be taking medication thinking it's going to help you. It's actually just to mimic and take your mind away from the pain. Just like I was prescribed a huge box of gabapentin. Gabapentin has a lot of side effects. So does ibuprofen. So does all this medicine. So you take the drugs and then you end up like I have with gallstones. And now the doctors will tell you you can't get rid of gallstones. So what happens is eventually once it gets so, well, you know, filled up with stones, it comes to effect that they're going to come to you to operate on you. So if they operate on you, guess what, folks? They're billing a whole lot of money to your insurance. They're making a whole lot of bank. So the longer that they keep you from getting the information of what the hell is going on with your health, they're basically milking every dime out of the system to the point where when you turn your head and you try to say, hey, okay, this is what we, you know, I want to know exactly what's going on here. By the time you turn around, they already done you in. And this needs to stop. It's designed, it's set up for a purpose to take people's homes away, take your possessions away, have you sell them off, have you in the street indulgent. And this is the reason why you see so many people in homelessness all over the city. It's not for them being crazy and demented. They were in a situation, they may have been in a housing crisis. It could be young people out there that were in school that could not afford the tuition and lodging, so they just hang out in the street every day, kind of go back and forth to class to get some type of certificate or something so they can use that to get work. These people want to work, but they can't because of what's being set up here in the United States. The only way to change and challenge this stuff is once you put a freeze on the cost of living index. Don't let that sucker go up. Let the job funding go up. Let everything else go up, but do not allow them to just come in and take away everything that you have set there and created to make an adjustment to people in their lives. And as I told Dr. I'm saying here, we need to come back and really revisit. The only way we can do that is once we get out here, we need to show my card or talk to someone. Tell them about these programs you're hearing and tell them that I'm not willing to go. Meaning, you know, I'm not going with this. I am not going with this. And everything, if we keep doing this in unity, you know, guess what? Things are going to change. Things will change. If you do nothing, then nothing happens. When you make a movement, it's a positive movement, then things happen and change. And then you can take that from that aspect and build on it. So, again, we have the science program. We have the dean of all deans, Steve Williams. He's going to be on every Tuesday at 8 o'clock Central Time. And he's going to talk to you, man, about relationships and how, what, and who is important. And you're going to see a situation where a lot of people are going to see a huge change. They're going to see a huge positive change. So it's going to take us, all of us, that listening to Blog Talk Radio, the D. Ambrose Show, because I'm going to bring the top liners of what your condition is right now and how we can spin this around and make everything work out and for a reason that you can afford. So anyway, I'm going to end on this note, and I thank you for listening. This is Deanne Burley, and I'm on the Detectors Radio Broadcast Network. Thank you. Good night and peace.